battle over eminent domain in 2005 thrust the owner of a small house in Connecticut into a series of vicious legal battles that wound up in the United States Supreme Court, and the High Court's ruling on the case forever changed our rights as property owners. In his latest book, investigative journalist Jeff Benedict tells the story of Suzette Kilo versus the City of New London. The Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage, is published by Hachette, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Benedict to the show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
What did the City of New London want from this plot of land?
They had just reached a deal with Pfizer Corporation. Pfizer had agreed to bring in their global research and development headquarters, and part of the agreement called for the city to acquire 90 additional acres around the new Pfizer site to build a corporate park and a hotel and things of that nature.
Had Pfizer approached the city, or were they wooing Pfizer by making this offer?
Well, they wooed Pfizer with a bunch of other things, which wasn't quite enough. And Pfizer said, we'll do it, essentially, but we'd also like to kind of remake the neighborhood around us.
And that land was land that everybody thought was sacrificable?
Well, a lot of the land, to be honest, was old industrial sites and businesses that were somewhat run down. And that part of the land moved rather easily. But there was an old neighborhood there about 100 years old, and those homeowners wanted to stay.
Do you think that the city officials and some of the other people involved, like Claire Gaudiani, had the city's best interest at heart?
I think they did. I think they thought they were doing right by the city and helping the city generate jobs and taxes. I don't think they cared too much, though, for the people who lived in those homes.
Well, this book is written through Suzette Kilo's lens. So you've made a decision that even though there would be new jobs and money added to the tax base at a limited cost to the community, that in the end, Suzette Kilo had the better argument?
I think that this could have easily been done without taking these homes. They wanted 90 acres. The homes comprised less than 3 acres. They had about 87 acres acquired. They could have started building then, but this fight is actually over 3 acres.
So why did they insist on the 3 acres? Because it cost the city a lot of money. That'd go to court.
A lot of money and a lot of time, and to this day they've built nothing. I think this really came down to a case of local politics and pride that prevailed over some common sense and good business sense.
So you say they built nothing. They built the Pfizer plant, ultimately, but all the other plans that were supposed to sweeten the deal, both for Pfizer and for the community, have never really been produced?
That's right. And Pfizer was separate. They were building their own facility, and that didn't involve eminent domain at all. The other 90 acres is really what's in question here, and they didn't build anything there. They knocked every house down and cleared it, but nothing has gone up.
How many homes were affected?
Over 70.
And why did Suzette Kilo become the central figure in this story? Did she have more at stake than any of the others?
No, I think in some respects you might say she had less. But she was the newest person to the neighborhood. She'd just gone through a divorce. It's the first time she'd ever owned property in her life. And when she found out it was going to get taken, months after she moved in, she put her foot down and wanted to stay.
Were they offering her a reasonable price?
Depends what you call reasonable. I mean, she bought the house for about $50,000. It was in really bad shape. She remade it and made it into a beautiful home. And then they came along and offered her essentially $70,000 to buy it.
So she went to a lawyer. Who took on her case and the case of the other plaintiffs?
She actually didn't go to a lawyer. The neighborhood community rallied around her, and one of them wrote a letter to a law firm in Washington, D.C. called the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm interested in property rights. They took the case, and it's the good thing they did because none of the homeowners really had the money to hire a law firm.
And some did sell, didn't they?
Yes, in the beginning, especially the senior citizens. There were families that had been there for 3 generations. A lot of them were very elderly, and they were scared. They thought they were told by realtors, if you don't sell now, you're going to lose your houses.
How have eminent domain laws been used traditionally? Have they been used in this way?
No. Typically, eminent domain laws have been used for public uses. So you take private property to build a road, a hospital, a courthouse, et cetera.
That's something that's guaranteed by the 14th Amendment?
Under the Fifth. And essentially what happened here is that they equated public uses with public benefits because this land wasn't going to be taken for public uses, but it was going to generate some public benefits, higher tax revenues for the city and job creation.
Was the city forced to specify exactly what each parcel of land was to be used for?
Well, that's actually why they lost the case at the trial court level. When the judge asked the pivotal question, what are you going to do with the land that these houses are sitting on, they didn't have an answer. They didn't know what they were going to do with it. They just wanted it. And the trial judge said, you know, you have to at least be able to specify a use.
Mm-hmm. So they lost the case. So then the city of New London went to the next court.
Yeah, they appealed to the Connecticut Supreme Court, which reversed the lower court ruling 3-2. And then the homeowners and the Institute for Justice appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And I think most people thought the court would never take this case because they rarely take eminent domain cases. But the facts in this case are so unusual and so egregious, the case was taken.
What was the overall feeling in the town toward the new development plans? Did most people support them?
I think it was euphoric in the beginning. This was going to be a terrific boon for the city to get Pfizer and then all these other things that were coming with it. But as more and more information came out, as this case dragged on, I think people got less and less comfortable with it, including the local newspaper.
Well, Pfizer, as you said, was going to build a factory anyway, so they really didn't have much to gain. How much money did the city put into funding the development?
Actually, most of the money came from the state, and under Governor John Rowland, who really was the prime guy behind the deal with Pfizer in the city, he was really the push. And the state put in about $100 million into this project, basically $1 for every $3 Pfizer spent.
One of the key players is a woman named Claire Godiani. Her organization is the New London Development Corporation. What role did she play in mediating the deal between Pfizer and the state?
She's the broker. The governor was looking for a way to do this in New London without using the local New London city government. And they're highly Democratic. He's Republican. They set up this agency to do this development, and they chose her to run it. She was the president of Connecticut College at that time, very popular, very competent. And her main job is to make this development work. And it's her idea, actually, to try to lure Pfizer in. And she does it personally by reaching out directly to the president of the R&D facility.
But that's a private organization, isn't it?
It's quasi-private because they were getting their money from the state of Connecticut. They're not elected by the public, and that's what's tricky here. As this case gets ugly, one of the complaints was these folks who have the power of eminent domain don't answer to the voter. We can't vote them out.
Was this case purely a dispute over property rights? Could there be other things brought in, even criminal issues?
I would say
no. Conflict of interest?
I don't think there's any criminal issues here, but I do think there's more here than just property rights. I think I say this in the top of the book. I think this is a story about pride. There's good pride, people who fought to protect what was theirs, and there's bad pride, the kind of pride that comes with arrogance and people who had this power and thought we can do what we want.
My guest is Jeff Benedict, who is the author of 8 books, including The Mormon Way of Doing Business, Out of Bounds, Pro and Cons, Without Reservation. His latest is Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage, One Woman's Historic Battle Against Eminent Domain. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. So it went to the Supreme Court. And what did the court finally decide?
There's a great exchange in the court where the Justice Scalia and O'Connor asked the city's attorney, is it okay, essentially, if you had a Motel 6 in New London and you wanted to replace it with a Ritz-Carlton? Could you kick out Motel 6 and bring in Ritz-Carlton? Yes. And Scalia says, wait a minute, let me just make sure I get this straight. You're saying we can take from A and give to B if B pays higher taxes? Yes. That's really where this case changes the rules dramatically. You don't have to have a public use. And from now back to the formation of the country, you had to have a public use. Under this decision, you don't.
And Scalia calls himself a strict constructionist. So I would assume that he would see this new argument as something that's unacceptable. How did the court split?
The 5-4 split was Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and O'Connor, who went on the side of the homeowners. It's upside down when you think about it because
we would think of them as the conservatives going with business.
With business. And the liberal justice is sticking up for the little guy here. And it goes the other way.
So who wrote the majority opinion?
It was written by Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. Who is the swing justice in cases of this sort?
And the opinion that everybody cites today is actually the dissent. by O'Connor, because she's the one who pens the famous lines about how this has changed the rules and now every farm, factory, and house in America is at risk if you apply this standard.
So what happened to Suzette and the other plaintiffs? How did they react to this decision? Oh, boy, we just got to go now?
It was the opposite. We're not going. And they didn't go. They refused to leave. And that's kind of the – how do you execute this decision? And for a year, they held out beyond the decision. And when it was clear that you were going to have to drag these people out, the new governor of Connecticut dispatched some agents with big checkbooks who went down, and they were paid what some would consider exorbitant sums to vacate and go. Suzette was last, and hers is the only house that's spared. The house was taken down board by board, put on flatbed trucks, and driven across town and reconstructed where it sits today.
Do you think the notoriety of this case hindered the development of the property beyond the building of the Pfizer plant?
Well, I'm sure it didn't help. The other thing that hurt was how long it took to get through litigation, which takes you back to why didn't the city settle earlier, I mean, and build? Now they've built nothing.
People were outraged when the Supreme Court made that decision. How did other states react to it?
43 states have since changed or modified, some would say upgraded, their eminent domain laws. A number of them have passed constitutional amendments to prevent these kind of kilo takings. There's a handful of states that haven't, but there's been an enormous backlash to this decision that I think has a positive uptick, at least for people who are concerned about eminent domain abuse.
So the Supreme Court's decision only carries weight in states that haven't changed their laws.
Essentially, I think what the Supreme Court was saying here is, look, Connecticut's law is what it is. If you don't like it, change the law.
But there have been other previous eminent domain cases, haven't there, decided by the Supreme Court?
Sure.
Berman versus Parker in 54, Hawaiian Housing Authority versus Midkiff in 1984. What did they decide in those cases?
Well, those are different cases than this. The Hawaii case was really about, you know, how to distribute all the property that had been controlled by just a few, you know, very powerful landowners there. O'Connor was actually involved in that decision, and that's why some people predicted in this case she was going to side with the city. But I think when the city's attorney made the admission that you could knock out a Motel 6 for a Ritz-Carlton, that's really when I think she went the other way.
It is odd that you would think the populist aspect of this case would have caused the voting to be quite different.
I was very surprised.
And what was the argument that they gave, the people who decided in favor of the city of New London?
That about 50% of New London's land is not taxable. It's owned by government institutions, nonprofits, military bases, et cetera. There's a lot of low-income housing. In order for us to do redevelopment, we need land. And if we can't purchase it, we have to have that power of eminent domain.
And in the end, it didn't really help the city of New London. This cost them a lot of money.
Well, and it cost them a lot more than that. I think they have a scarlet letter on their forehead that's going to be around for a long time because they're remembered as the city that threw people out of their houses and then built nothing.
Well, when this case hit the newspapers, it seemed pretty cut and dry to most of the public. Is this as simple a thing as the government being unfair to the small guy?
Well, I think it is. Look, this is a complicated, layered story. But I think when you cut through all that, at the end of the day, what you realize is the city had control of 87 acres. They wanted 90. Their developer said, we can do this without taking those houses. We could incorporate these old homes into a new plan. You stop right there and you say, look, do we fight to the death on the legal argument that we think we can win, or should we make a smart business decision?
But what about the other argument here, that it involved urban renewal, that this was a blighted area and they were going to make it into something more valuable for everyone?
The problem with that is these houses weren't blighted. You could argue that some of these industrial properties three blocks away were blighted, but the homes weren't, and the homes were a separate neighborhood. And the city never alleged that the houses were blighted.
Well, because so many states have passed laws that prevent this sort of thing from happening in the future, can't we say that there's been a positive effect, even if it was for a negative reason?
I think there's no question. I mean, there's an O. Henry ending to this story. If they hadn't fought this fight and lost, there would have been no reform. They would have kept their homes, and then, but in every other state, there'd be these enormous risks still out there.
Are we still seeing eminent domain cases being heard?
Yes, absolutely. All over the country, including right here in New York.
And I think that we're going to probably see more if we start doing things to build up the infrastructure as part of this new economic reconstruction plan, because one of the possibilities is having high-speed railroads, and that would mean taking over some land, wouldn't it? Would that be a more positive use of eminent domain, do you think?
Well, I think that's actually a more acceptable use, or old kind of eminent domain use that's allowable. I think what you have to worry about is in tough economic times when municipalities and cities don't have money, they can use the "we can raise taxes and create jobs" argument to take property.
You said that these kinds of cases are occurring right here in New York. Are they cases that New Yorkers would be upset to learn about?
Oh, yeah. We were just at Columbia University a few days ago. And, you know, there's land being taken in a neighborhood nearby that is involves Columbia University. And we were at a forum there that was highly controversial.
Yeah, because Columbia right now, many people, legislators support it, others support it. But there are people in the area who are very upset. The same thing happened around Shea Stadium, didn't it?
I'm not as familiar with the Shea Stadium plan.
Well, there's an attempt by the city to clean up the area as a part of the development and the creation of this new ballpark. Mm. And a lot of auto repair shops and the like will be moved. And as far as they're concerned, where do we go to? Is there any area that will take us anymore?
Right. And that's an issue that you see in lots of places when they move businesses. Where do we go now, especially a family-owned one?
What's happened in Connecticut? Have they changed the laws in the state?
Connecticut's actually one of the few states that really hasn't done the upgrade. They made a very modest change that really is a toothless law.
What's your next project?
How to build a business Warren Buffett would buy.
Well, if you know the answer, could you send me the manuscript before the thing is published? Jeff Benedict's latest book is called Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage, One Woman's Historic Battle Against Eminent Domain. It is published by Grand Central Publishing, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.